From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headley. The Senate has tabled health care reform for now, but Medicaid is still very much on the chopping block.
What our goal is to make it so folks on Medicaid, the most vulnerable in our society, those moms and kids and the seniors and the disabled, that program works for them.
That's Republican Tom Price, Secretary of Health and Human Services. One in five Georgians are insured by Medicaid or its complement for children, Peach Care. We talk about who the safety net will protect later this hour. But first, yesterday we heard a conversation with photographer Billy Howard about making portraits of people infected with HIV during the 1980s.
The reason that he trusted me was that the first thing I did when I met him was reach out to shake his hand. And that was a period of time when a lot of healthcare workers would not touch somebody with AIDS unless they had latex gloves on. And
here are your first thoughts.
Hello, my name is Tamara, and I'm calling from the Savannah area. I had interviewed for a position as a public health nurse working with HIV patients, and the starting pay was $32,000 a year. That is not a comparable pay for a bachelor's prepared nurse to work with a high-risk population. So if Georgia wants to decrease its HIV infection rate, they need skilled, fairly paid public health nurses to go out into the community and work with high-risk populations. Until they're willing to invest in fighting this horrible virus, things are only going to get worse.
We always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature some of your comments on the program. President Trump has unveiled his plan for tougher trade restrictions on Cuba.
Our new policy begins with strictly enforcing U.S. law. We will not lift sanctions on the Cuban regime until all political prisoners are freed.
Some of the biggest losers could be Georgia chicken farmers. Georgia is a leading poultry producer. Cuba is its second largest market. Joining us now is James Sumner, president of the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council. Also with us is Marissa Ann Pognatero. She is a professor of business ethics at the University of Georgia. Thank you both for being with us. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
So, Jim first and then to Marissa, same question. When you heard that from the president, Jim, what was your reaction?
Well, we didn't know what to think. U.S. chicken, and a lot of that comes from Georgia, has become the leading export to Cuba, practically our only export to Cuba. And it's been growing every year for the last 15 years since we lifted the trade restrictions for agricultural products about 15 years ago. So we were concerned.
Yeah. Marissa, how about you? What was your reaction?
Well, I was concerned about how it would go into effect and what the ramifications would be for business. And so as we take a look at what actually was part of that announcement, we'll see that he didn't completely roll back President Obama's policies, only parts of them.
Jim, when the Obama administration eased some of the financial restrictions and U.S. firms could begin offering Cuban-run businesses credit, did Georgia take advantage of that, take that opportunity to expand its chicken business with Cuba?
Well, we've never been able to extend credit to Cuba. That's one of the things that was never accomplished. I think Obama wanted to, but it was not. And in fact, the fact that we cannot extend them credit has ensured that we have been paid for every pound of chicken that we've delivered to Cuba. Mm. And we're the only country in the world, I'm sure, that can say that. Cuba does not have the best record of paying its debts.
Right, right. Jim, did you see the president's statement? Boy, if he truly means it, every word of it, in part that Cuba has to release all of its political prisoners, and I don't think none of us can see that, envision that happening. So if the president is to be taken at his word, do you see it as a threat to Georgia's chickens, to Cuba trade relationship?
Well, we met with one of Sonny Perdue's, his top trade advisor, just a week ago. Actually, the day before the president made his announcement in Miami, And we were assured that trade would not be affected. And since we're practically the only trade,
that set
well with our group that was meeting at that time. So we're hoping that's not the case. But you never know how the Cuban government, and it's actually the Cuban government, an arm of the Cuban government, Al Import, that our industry sells to. You never know how they're going to react. But I think the long and the short of it is Cuba is desperate for the product. They can find no other protein that is more economical than chicken leg quarters, which is a result of U.S. consumers preferring the breast meat so we can sell the leg quarters cheaper. So
U.S. consumers prefer the white meat, and the Cubans prefer the brown meat.
And so does most everybody else around the world.
Most everyone else, okay.
It works. It's a marriage made in heaven.
Okay, so Marissa, what did you learn from your recent trip to Cuba? Do the Cuban people they want more trade with the United States?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. It was amazing how much enthusiasm there was around President Obama's visit to Cuba. It signaled an opening of trade, and the amount of people we met who were entrepreneurs in the travel sector was stunning, particularly people who were renting their homes through Airbnb, private sector restaurants. It was definitely thriving, and I was surprised to see it.
Yeah, if you're just joining me, I'm speaking with James Sumner, president of the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council, and Marissa Ann Pagnotaro, a professor at the University of Georgia. And Jim, take us back a bit here. In 1960, only medicine and canned goods, right, could be shipped to Cuba. How did Georgia get into this business, into the chicken business with Cuba? Did it start in 2002?
yes, 2001, 2002 with Hurricane Michelle. And at that time, our government offered Cuba food aid, and Castro very cleverly said, "I'm not going to accept your handouts. I'll only take it if I can pay for it." Mm-hmm. And that's what started agriculture and food trade with Cuba. And we were quick to take a trade group down there in 2002 and met personally with Fidel. And at that time, he said, "You know," he says, "I've done some studying," and he says, "I can compute easily that it's more economical for us to import our chicken from the U.S. than it is to try and produce our own." They still grow their own eggs,
but they've
been dependent upon imports ever since then. And prior to then, Canada and Europe and South America was primarily supplying them, but since 2002, it's been predominantly the U.S.
Right. So, Marissa, you're our professor of business ethics. I'm wondering, was there much thought, much discussion as to whether Georgia should be doing business at all, of any kind, with Cuba, given its human rights record?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think that a lot of people believe that pressure to make progress on human rights is a condition to opening trade is not particularly successful. I spent a lot of time looking at China, and if you look at that as a model, you can see that they were allowed to join the WTO in 2001, and now it's a flourishing economy despite the fact that there are still human rights issues. So with Cuba, opening trade, I think, is a way for people to get a voice. An important point, I think, to really focus on is that when President Obama entered into negotiations, part of that was opening up the internet to Cuba. Mm-hmm. And now the Cuban government has opened public Wi-Fi access. And that is, you know, an essential component to changing both the commercial and political landscape, I think, in Cuba.
Yeah, but Marissa, I guess the more poignant question is, has doing business with Cuba meant aiding a repressive regime? And if the answer to that is yes, how do we feel about that?
I mean, that's a difficult call. I mean, in some ways, you could say it aids the regime. In another way, you're helping the Cuban people get on their feet. I mean, trade with Cuba has opened up tremendous opportunities for the Cuban people. So I think that you have to look at the larger picture. Interestingly enough, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch has been in favor of President Obama's policies to open up trade.
Yeah, yeah. Jim, I'll put that same question to you because, look, you've been dealing with this from the very beginning. What are your thoughts on this question of whether doing business with Cuba has meant aiding a repressive regime. Have you kicked that discussion around a bit?
We have, and it's obvious that the Cuban government was trying to make use of this as a political ploy to gain more support. I mean, they would methodically go to different states and import products from as many different states as they could and receive congressional delegations. I think they were pretty good at political upsmanship. But, you know, we kind of look at it from the standpoint, like Maria said, of helping the people. And if they don't have chicken to eat, if they don't have protein, they're going hungry. And in fact, the recent uptake in tourism to Cuba really put a strain on their food supply, and a lot of the chicken that was going to their own citizens got used for tourists instead. So this puts some further strains in the system. Yeah. So it's an interesting dynamic.
Well, let me push that dynamic a little further here. Jim, has any of the profits made through the sale of Georgia chickens to Cuba gone to those whose property, right, was confiscated by the Cuban government during the Castro years?
Well, I don't think we have too many former Cuban exiles in the poultry industry.
Sure.
But what we have done, we have taken some of the proceeds, and our World Poultry Foundation has tried to invest and support the Cuban egg industry to bring it out of its pre-1920 era situation and to try to provide assistance to them just as a showing of goodwill. So we have done that with our organizations.
So, Marissa, as you sit here today, do you want to see the embargo fully lifted?
Ultimately, yes. I think that opening trade will lead to changes within Cuba. But I think it probably is something that needs to take place step by step in terms of negotiations with the Cubans.
And Jim, do you see the former, first of all, do you share that view? And if you do you see the former Georgia governor, current agriculture secretary, Sonny Perdue, pushing to lift the embargo?
Well, I do agree that we would like to see the embargo lifted. Of course, if we had U.S. tourism, that would raise their economy to a new level that would benefit everyone and all sorts of commerce in Georgia and elsewhere, including our airlines and such. But whether Secretary Perdue will take that position, I don't know. I know he's a big supporter of our poultry industry, and sometimes I think you can only go so far in pushing President Trump into certain areas. But he's been remarkable that he's been somewhat flexible, and when presented with both sides, I think he has oftentimes erred in the popular opinion. So we just hope that's continues to be the case.
You've said a mouthful there. That is Jim Sumner, president of the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council. Marissa Ann Pagnotero is associate dean and professor at UGA Terry College of Business. Thank you both. And just ahead, shining a light on local government transparency from the Blue Ridge to the Fulton County Courthouse. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Last week, the U.S. Senate lifted the veil of secrecy on its plan to overhaul America's healthcare system. A vote on the bill won't happen until after the July 4th recess. However, it appears clear that any legislation will significantly impact Medicaid in Georgia. We may see deep cuts and other restructuring for the first time in half a century. With me to talk about this is Andy Miller, editor of Georgia Health News, Laura Harker. She is health policy analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, and Caroline Mortensen is on the line with us. She is a professor of health sector management and policy at the University of Miami. Good morning to each of you.
Good to be here.
Yeah, boy, I need your help. I need your help. Laura, look, I'm trying to get good information that I can understand, that I can process, that I can trust. Yes. So will you help me here? So here's my first question. Why do you believe, in the final analysis, it seems pretty straightforward and simple, why the Senate bill was pulled?
I would say that there still needs to be some time to really think about some of the cuts to Medicaid that would happen with a cap, as well as some of the changes to the marketplace. Some people would have fewer subsidies to help them pay for insurance. And so we really have to take some time to think about how people would be affected and who would lose coverage.
So Medicaid concerns and marketplace concerns. Andy, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think this bill has many more losers than winners. You know, not only are 22 million people going to lose coverage as a result if this bill becomes law, but as Laura pointed out, the Medicaid program will go through substantial cuts, and we may see people lose benefits. Many people lose benefits and eligibility for this vital program.
Yeah, and Caroline, what's your view on this? So more losers than winners, as Andy sort of outlined here in the Senate proposal as it stands now. We know that it's going to be reworked.
I agree with both Andy and Laura, and we have to keep in mind what we have are two things going on here. First, the cuts to Medicaid that are included in the replacement bills, but also the $800 billion in cuts that are included in the Trump budget. So combined, even if this version of the replacement bill doesn't go through, we still have President Trump looking at significant cuts to the Medicaid program, and you have very few Republicans that actually approve of any of the elements of the replacement bill right now.
You know, so Andy, I read an estimate that it could lead, the Senate version of this bill could lead to even more Georgians without health insurance than the 720,000 estimate under the House version passed in May. Is that an accurate number based on the reporting you've done?
Well, we're looking at anywhere from 680,000 to 700,000. Those are just estimates based on what the CBO has estimated. Many of those people right now could be in Medicaid. They could have private insurance, but they'll drop out because either they won't qualify for the Medicaid coverage anymore, or the private insurance will be too expensive for them under this bill.
Yeah. Laura, is there a big hit to come, maybe already in place, for hospitals in Georgia with the passage of some version of the AHCA?
Yes, we have done some analysis on how the Medicaid cuts would affect hospitals. And the Medicaid share by hospital varies, but hospitals on average in rural areas receive about 13% of their revenue from Medicaid. So any cuts to Medicaid would significantly affect all hospitals' bottom lines.
So we spoke with Kelly McCutcheon, president of the Georgia Public Policy Foundation. He says the new bill that's being reworked now will actually help simplify family Medicaid plans.
Children and parents should be able to be on the same plan. If one child's on Peach Care and one and the mother is on Medicaid, they should be able to be on the same plan. Integrating those funding streams is something that Georgia could do with a waiver and that this bill allows.
So, Caroline, I guess part of the reason that we wanted to have this discussion is to get a better handle on what is accurate information. Is Kelly accurate there? Many of us are trying to figure this out.
Sure. I think in a lot of ways Medicaid could be improved and simplified, but it is a cost-effective way to provide affordable health insurance coverage to a lot of people who need it. So I think simplification makes sense, but how do you simplify as you're simultaneously cutting the budget, cutting the increases in growth over time? So you're saying become more simple and become better while we fund you less and less.
So what seems absolutely clear, I think, to each and every one of us here is that the big shiny object to be whacked is Medicaid, correct?
Well, yeah, $800 billion or somewhere along that number over 10 years, that's a lot of money. And it translates into states are going to have to make more decisions as to how they're going to, who's going to be covered. And if they have less money, who are they going to, are they going to drop people, some people, like people who get waivers in the community to stay in the community? These are people with disabilities. Are they going to, you know, just eligibility cuts, benefit cuts, or cuts to providers and pay doctors and hospitals less?
So this is Kelly McCutcheon again from the Georgia Public Policy Foundation.
Georgia and other states, we spend about 50% less than the national average on our aged and disabled, most expensive population in Medicaid. the CMS director now is authorized to bump us up to 2 percentage points a year until we are within 25% of the national average. That's fantastic for Georgia. So I think that the worry about cuts is a little overwrought. I think if you read the bill and continue to analyze the impact on Georgia, it's not going to be as bad as people think.
So, Laura, Andy, Caroline, who believes that Kelly actually has a point here when he says that concern about the proposed cuts has gotten a bit overwrought?
I would say that Georgia does already spend a low amount of money on Medicaid compared to other states. And if we were locked in with a cap, that would lock us in at a low rate. So even if we were bumped up, it may not be sufficient to keep up with economic downturns or higher costs of health care as that occurs.
And Caroline, do you have a take on what Kelly is saying here?
Sure. I think big picture, it would be great to see a state like Georgia benefit from something like this, but it sounds like it might be at the peril of other states that are in the United States. I wanted to focus back on that 22 million number mm-hmm. as well. I don't think we should focus so much on the number. The number is important, but I think we should focus on President Trump's promise, which was better, lower cost health care for everyone with no cuts to Medicaid. And nowhere in here do you see that. So I think we should focus on the magnitude of these insurance losses that we'll see over time and that we were promised that this wouldn't happen.
Let's talk about that. But before we get to that point, and maybe it's addressed a little bit here, here's a former Georgia congressman and current Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price talking about the proposed Medicaid cuts on CNN recently.
The Medicaid proposal in the Senate bill goes up every single year that the plan's in place. What our goal is to make it so folks on Medicaid, the most vulnerable in our society, those moms and kids and the seniors and the disabled, that program works for them in a way that allows them to get the kind of care and the coverage that they need. In addition to those who are also in the vulnerable category, that they're able to get the kind of coverage that they want and need for their family.
And Caroline, I hear you saying that the president made a clear promise about health care that he is not keeping, either with his budget proposals or with what's being worked out in the Senate right now.
I think that's right. And I think just listening to what Secretary Price said, he's talking about changing over time the federal proportion of the Medicaid expansion, which will put a greater burden on the states. If you look at just the last few years of the expansion, the federal government has paid $70 billion of that, and states have only had to bear $4 billion. Part of this replacement plan is that the burden on the states will continue to increase.
So, Andy, when Senate Republicans, House Republicans, take a look at Medicaid, what do they see? How do they view Medicaid?
I think it depends largely on whether those people are from states that have expanded Medicaid versus those that haven't. If you listen to John Kasich in Ohio, the governor of Ohio, if you talk to Dean Heller, who's one of these senators who have said no to this plan, they have seen real progress in those states that expanded in terms of if you just look at the people with opioid addictions. That expansion population, that program has actually helped those people get services that they need to get treatment. And so those states, those 31 states, representatives from them, have really seen some impact, some positive impact from Medicaid expansion.
You know, and Andy, stay with that point here. Remind us of everything and everyone covered by Medicaid.
There's 2 million people in Georgia.
Yeah.
There are two-thirds of them are kids. These are kids from poor families. It also covers more than 70% of people in nursing homes in this state. Medicaid covers more than half of the births in the state, childbirths in the state. So it's a tremendously important program, that really impacts, 20% of our population.
And Laura, what happens to those people? We're talking about proposals that would slow the rate of spending, right, in Medicaid?
Yes. I think it would be especially concerning for people who have long-term care needs, like people with disabilities or seniors who are getting care in nursing homes. As Andy mentioned, Medicaid pays for a lot of the long-term care services in the state. And so these are services people need for the long term, and any cuts will affect their ability to be productive.
Caroline, Florida, like Georgia, didn't expand Medicaid under the ACA. How is that working out in Florida?
Well, right around the time that the expansion was occurring in other states, Florida moved the vast majority of our fee-for-service Medicaid enrollees into a managed care program. And so although we didn't expand it to more people, you have about 3.6 million people in Florida who have Medicaid coverage. And in my research, I've been able to find that moving them to managed care and guaranteeing them access to a primary care provider has started to increase their access to health care, and we see some better health outcomes for them. But this is not addressing people who are left in the gap because they didn't expand Medicaid. You see, though, that more people in South Florida purchased on the exchanges with the subsidies than any other zip code in the United States. So the subsidies on the exchanges for low-income individuals to purchase into private health insurance coverage has been sort of the success story coming out of Florida.
We asked Atlantans, do you think having Medicaid coverage is important? Here are some responses.
Miriam Panton, and I live in Brookhaven. Yes, it is important because not everybody is fortunate to have their personal health insurance.
My name is Zach Davison. The very few people I know that have Medicaid, they are able to go and get seen when they can't afford private insurance and they can't afford the high medical bills.
Shinka Kareem, Atlanta, Georgia.
I definitely think that it is. And, my grandmother had used it, before she passed and different things like that. So it had been beneficial to her. It's been beneficial to my relatives.
So, Andy, Caroline, Laura, look, I need some real clarity on this next one. The question is the Affordable Care Act actually collapsing? Here's Paul Ryan defending the need to replace the Affordable Care Act.
This law is collapsing. It's in a tailspin. We have a duty and an obligation to step in front of that collapse and rescue the healthcare system for people who are in the individual market. Every Republican senator campaigned on repealing and replacing this law.
Well, that's the House Speaker, Paul Ryan. Laura, to you first. Is the Affordable Care Act collapsing?
In the recent Congressional Budget Office study, they did find that most markets are relatively stable, especially in urban areas, so in Metro Atlanta. Rural areas are seeing a little bit more difficulty because there are less insurers there and less people to enroll. But overall, those people in rural areas are protected because most of them get a subsidy to help them afford insurance.
Caroline?
I agree with everything she just said. So we need to remember that most Americans feel that the Republicans and Trump own the Affordable Care Act. It is the law of the land, and that is our administration. And they are not doing their best efforts to make sure that this plan stays successful. There are small things that they could do. There are some payments to insurers that they could guarantee, some promises to insurers that it's okay to cover these high-risk populations, and the Trump administration is unwilling to make those commitments. And so understandably, some of the insurers are pulling out of some of the markets.
So wait a minute, Andy. We all at the table don't agree on this. Is the Affordable Care Act collapsing as the House Speaker suggests?
Well, I think there are certain areas of the state and the country where it's not working like it should. There are problems with insurers, not enough competition. And what health insurers look for is stability and certainty. And they're seeing a lot of uncertainty and chaos coming out of Washington right now. They're not being guaranteed the subsidies that help people offset their out-of-pocket costs. And they're also listening to the administration not enforcing the individual mandate from the Affordable Care Act. And so many of them are making business decisions to not cover certain areas, certain geographies of this state and other states.
And Andy, what are the Georgia politics here around this issue? Better to pass a bill even if it leaves more Georgians uninsured, underinsured than not to fulfill a promise?
Well, I think that's, they have gone on record for 7 years saying we need to repeal and replace Obamacare. But now that they're actually having to do this, I mean, and they're seeing how difficult it is to come up with a solution that can be popular and can work and cover just as many people or more. It's a very, very difficult proposition that they're looking at.
Laura, what's your take on the politics at play here?
I would agree with what Andy is saying. Now that we're 6 months or so into this process of trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, seeing the concern from people who may lose coverage or benefits through Medicaid or the marketplace, there's a lot of concern from a lot of people.
Thank you all. Thank you all for the conversation. That's Andy Miller. He's the editor of Georgia Health News. You also heard from Laura Harker. She is the health policy analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. and Caroline Mortensen, Professor of Health Sector Management and Policy at the University of Miami. Thank you all again.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
And still to come on the program, just ahead, a journalist shines some light on Georgia's clouded government operations. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we talk about Georgia's homeless pet population. The issue has been labeled the biggest challenge facing shelter and rescue operations in our state. What do you think needs to be done to better secure our furry friends? You can give us a call at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message. You can also let us know on Facebook or tweet us at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the program. I think we can all agree that government transparency is essential to democracy. Every year, the Investigative Reporters and Editors Group singles out the most secretive government agencies and individuals for its Golden Padlock Award. This weekend, it went to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Director Scott Pruitt, the Oklahoma Attorney General's Office, and the EPA. There were other finalists, including Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed and Appalachian Judicial Circuit Chief Judge Brenda Weaver. Robert Cribb chairs the awards committee, and he joins me from Toronto. And good morning to you, Robert. And also on the line with us is Robert Smith. He is a political science professor at Savannah State University. Robert, are you with us?
Yes, I am. And good morning to you. And thank you,
Robert. And welcome back to the program. Robert, let me ask you, generally speaking, for what your take is on the state of affairs when it comes to government transparency. Where are we right now?
Well, I think we're in a precarious state right now because, again, you want to always have a balance between transparency and openness in government and the ability of government to make decisions. And the primacy of transparency and openness in government, I think, at all levels cannot be overstated in any way. But there are times when being off the record, quote unquote, may be appropriate, and it's a matter of sort of balancing that in terms of functionality of government versus the full transparency that many of us as citizens might desire and expect from government.
And Robert Cribb is back with us. And Robert, how did the Golden Padlock Award actually come into being? What's kind of the origin story behind the award?
Well, I mean, I think it's a reflection of many years of frustration on the parts of journalists trying to access public records, government-held records that ultimately belong to the public and are sought in the public interest. And it so frequently is the case that we can't get access to them that, you know, there is a great pent-up frustration, I would say, in the journalistic community about that. And we often try and speak about it, but nobody really cares when we whine about not getting access to records. So this was an idea that I came up with to try and reflect it in a different way.
And Robert Cribb, what's the push-pull here? Is it elected officials who certainly have to understand they owe some accountability to the public just trying to figure out what they can hold when the question should be, let's get as much out there, how much can we share?
Yeah, for me, it's all about what is the default position, right? So we all agree that there is some information that should not be released publicly. I don't think there's any debate about that personal information. Nobody's trying to get access to your health records or to national security information that could compromise the safety of people. Nobody's arguing about that. What we're talking about is what is clearly public interest information. that the government has a responsibility to release. And the feeling, I would say, the journalistic position is that the default position of government in those cases should be to release, rather than the default position being what it very frequently is to figure out a way not to release. And that's a cultural right. issue. It's not just about legislation, it's not about the words of the legislation all the time. It's about the cultural, bureaucratic mindset.
Yeah. One more for you, Robert Cribb. Two of the 2017 nominees were from Georgia. From your group's perspective, why did the case of Judge Brenda Weaver in North Georgia make the cut?
Because it was extraordinary. I mean, it was an example of legal retaliation against a journalist for seeking public interest records. So in this case, this was a judge who became annoyed with a journalist who was pursuing a story vigorously. As a result of his public records requests and demands for transparency and openness, ultimately faced arrest and an evening in jail with his lawyer. I mean, it's just an extraordinary case of deep commitment to secrecy.
Yeah. Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed was nominated for the Padlock Award. Now, this was in response to his decision to print more than a million documents about a City Hall bribery scandal in response to a public records request. Robert Smith, what do you recall about this case and how extraordinary was it?
Well, I think it was certainly extraordinary in the case of the disclosure of what really was perhaps thousands of documents that certainly, again, I think there was some bit of a surprise about the nomination, but not necessarily unexpected once you realize the details of the circumstances, which is where there was clearly, it seemed to be, an attempt to sort of obfuscate or at least to deflect in some way, shape, or form from the mandate of disclosure by releasing the voluminous amount of materials. And so certainly it's not surprising, I suppose, that the nomination was forthcoming from the mayor.
You know, the mayor held a press conference to unveil more,
yes.
to release these documents. The large amount of documents included unreadable spreadsheets, I'm told, school lunch menus, crime reports, paving schedules. And during the press conference, the mayor talked about the need to present the documents in this particular way.
It took hours of preparation. We have borne the cost of that. We have not tried to shift the cost to the press. So today, we have some guidelines. We're going to lay them out, and we're going to make sure that we assist you. Because I also heard your concerns about this being just an attempt to give you so many documents that you couldn't possibly find what you needed to cover this investigation.
And we also asked the Jim Zachary of the Transparency Project of Georgia for his take on the large release of documents.
The people of Atlanta should look at something like that and find it to be very poor public service. I don't think it's an indictment on Mayor Reed's entire administration, but it clearly was an abuse. Here's one thing that open government advocates have said for a very long time. If you have nothing to hide, why hide?
Robert Smith, was this abusive?
Well, I don't know if I would go to the extent of calling it abusive, but it certainly was an attempt, I think, to obfuscate the public record by simply providing voluminous documents that may or may not have any direct bearing on the issue at hand. And in that particular case, I think that it was perhaps not in best form, let's say that.
And Robert Cribb, the mayor's spokesman, had some tough words for your organization, saying in a statement that, quoting now, if the organization's mission is truly dedicated to improving the quality of investigative reporting, then this nomination is not only baffling, but an insult to the hardworking women and men of the Reed administration who worked expeditiously to produce more than 2 million pages of documents without compromising an ongoing federal investigation and the privacy of innocent individuals. What's your reaction to that statement?
I think that the men and women who did all of that work did indeed work far too hard. I agree with that. It's a classic needle in the haystack technique of secrecy. And we're seeing it more and more. One of the reasons that we chose that particular case is because it is reflective thematically of sort of a new approach in bureaucracies across North America, which traditionally used the sort of the technique of delay and deny. Mm. So they gave you nothing. This is kind of a new trendy method, which is to shower you with irrelevance and paper, when in fact digital information would be far more appropriate. In fact, the administration did produce digital information for the FBI. They just didn't make it available to reporters that day because it was a spectacle. It was a show designed to give the air of transparency, when in fact it was clearly designed to obfuscate the details.
So I asked this question of Robert Smith. Let me ask you, Robert Cribb. I'm always surprised at governments that they're so concerned with what they withhold. How would you sort of more broadly characterize the current moment when it comes to government openness?
So I would say that it is getting worse. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. The techniques of secrecy, I mean, I don't know if they all go to the same conferences. They all seem to be aligned in their techniques and the methodologies of this. It's increasingly sophisticated. And they also understand that newsrooms across the country are incredibly resource-strapped. I mean, this is tough times for journalism, and it's a perfect opportunity to use techniques like needle in the haystack to simply get journalists to throw their hands up and say, listen, I don't have time for this. I got to walk away. So it's great. It's a great time to be a secrecy-minded bureaucrat.
Yeah, and the argument seems to be, or we've heard it at times, perhaps articulated this way, look, enough is enough. I'm bogged down. You could certainly hear this in what the mayor was suggesting. Enough is enough. I'm bogged down with open records requests, that I can't get my people to do the people's work, that I'm being harassed by reporters. Is there an argument that there is some journalistic overreach going on here? Robert Smith.
I don't think so. I think that journalists need to do their job. And it seems to me that, again, that primacy of transparency and openness in government needs to be sort of at center stage. And I think this is part of the public sphere. It is part of the public's work whenever there are inquiries into the substantive work that governments do. And so, no, it doesn't seem to be inappropriate whatsoever to have those expectations.
And I'm wondering, Robert Cribb, to what extent are the fake news allegations and suggestions coming from the White House hindering the watchdog role of the press?
You know, it's a really fascinating question. I think the answer is unfolding still. I don't think we know the answer to that. I think it's very clear that it has poisoned the minds of many against the media. Effectively. So to some extent, it's rhetoric that has effectiveness. I also think there's an unintended consequence happening where it is raising questions, really for the first time in my memory, where the public isn't actually engaging in conversations about the role of the media. And there's backlash against that. There is, I think, increasingly a feeling that it's unfair criticism.
Right.
In fact, the press is playing a vital role and asking the very important questions that need to be asked.
Robert Cribb and Robert Smith, thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Judge Brenda Weaver was nominated for the Padlock Award after jailing a newspaper publisher in Blue Ridge, Georgia. Mark Thomason and his attorney were taken into custody over a public records request Thomason submitted. Thomason asked for copies of cash checks that he described as being illegally cashed. For that, he was charged with making a false statement. Charges were later dropped. Thomason's newspaper, The Fan and Focus, launched in 2014.
It was really started because this area in North Georgia needed, I felt, a source of news that told the truth, presented unbiased, accurate information, and worked to better the community. This area of North Georgia had never really had the watchdog hard-nosed reporting.
The Focus folded in December of last year. During its roughly 2.5-year existence, the paper dug its teeth into investigative journalism. Thomason and his reporters uncovered the possible misuse of funds within the county's recreation department.
of the county ultimately terminated that recreation director. Finances are a lot more transparent to the public now. The county is accounting for funds there. There's money available. That program can be bettered. We felt like we gave that some real exposure.
The paper also reported on a racial slur used by another judge during a court hearing.
The judge that had uttered the racial slurs is no longer on the bench. And that's kind of what led into our coverage of this public taxpayer account being used to pay non-county workers personal bills.
Thomason's coverage got statewide and national attention. As he continues to get news tips, he says there is still a need for investigative journalism in this small town and others like it. He attributes his paper's demise to sinking ad sales.
So our advertising base quickly started to dwindle, and it made surviving tough. Within a period of about 90 days, we went from over 10 employees down to about 3. And it was just hard to survive without that source of revenue.
Thomason says pressure to pull the ads came from people with close ties to local government. Journalist Jim Zachary is with the Transparency Project of Georgia. He says it's sad to see the paper is no more.
Anytime any newspaper closes in any market, that is a disservice to the public. Newspapers are very important for holding government accountable. And I think that anybody would be naive to think that the closure of the Fannie Focus was not directly related to the retaliation that the publisher faced from a judge.
Judge Weaver still presides in the 3-county Appalachian Judicial Circuit. But after Thomason's arrest, she resigned as chair of the state's Judicial Qualifications Commission. Thomason, meanwhile, now works in construction, but is hopeful that the Fannin Focus will one day make a comeback.
I think if more papers and more reporters took that approach, stopped walking on eggshells, and just always told the truth, eventually that clock pendulum will swing to the side of justice, and repercussions would not even be an option.
It's a sentiment echoed by Jim Zachary of the Transparency Project of Georgia.
Newspapers have a long legacy of being the fourth estate, holding government accountable. And I've told my colleagues across the state, any newspaper that does not advocate for the First Amendment, that does not advocate for greater government transparency, and that does not hold elected officials accountable is not worth the paper that it's printed on or the ink that fills its pages.
For a look back at our coverage of the Fannin Focus and its First Amendment issues involving the media, visit gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we always want to hear from you. Where do you get your local news? You can give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.